From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In the first half hour, we talk with two people who have just returned from Haiti, University of Iowa emergency medicine physician Chris Burrish and Cedar Rapids funeral director and Red Cross spokesperson Peter Tian. They'll tell us about their experiences in the disaster zone, where Burrish describes the air as thick with suffering. Then a conversation with Black Hawk County Public Health Director Tom O'Rourke, who is retiring. He'll reflect on his 36 years in the public health sector. That's all coming up. First, this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. An estimated 3 million people were affected by the January 12th earthquake in Haiti. Between 100 and 200,000 lost their lives. In our first half hour today, my guests are two people who recently returned from the disaster zone. Joining me in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, emergency medicine physician Dr. Chris Burrish is with us. You may remember shortly after the deadly quake, we spoke with Dr. Burrish by phone. He has made regular medical trips to Haiti for 7 years. He left Haiti just days before the disaster and returned there just a week after the earthquake struck. And now he's back in Iowa after 9 days of working at a makeshift portable hospital outside of Port-au-Prince, aiding more than 3,000 injured people. Dr. Burrish, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, Ben.
Also with us in the studio, Peter Tian, a licensed funeral director based in Cedar Rapids. For years, Peter Tian has lent his skills to both the development of disaster operation protocols as well as extensive volunteerism in disaster services. He is also president, founder of International Mass Fatalities Center. For over 10 years, he's been a national media spokesperson for the American Red Cross. And Peter just returned yesterday, from Haiti, where he was part of a three-man team whose responsibility was for the primary care of patients in the Port-au-Prince's largest hospital's critical care unit. Peter Tian, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
Thank you for making time. I imagine you must be very, very tired.
Well, I crashed last night and slept, and I'm surprised I'm awake today.
Dr. Burrish, let me start with you. We spoke in mid-January. You were very concerned. You were about to leave back to Haiti about the people you knew there and worked in Haiti. The place you know is outside of Port-au-Prince. What did you find when you arrived? Describe the landscape.
Well, it was I guess it was about what I'd imagined. Most of the buildings were down. Inside Port-au-Prince, I don't know what your experience was, Peter, but it seems like maybe half, 60% of buildings had come down. And then as you drove west through Carrefour, the destruction seemed a little bit worse. And as you hit Laogan, it was probably about 85% of buildings had been affected in some way. Even people that hadn't had their houses come down were afraid to live inside after the earthquake and the subsequent aftershocks. So most of them had built kind of makeshift houses in the street that were, you know, tarps or pieces of tin or sometimes even just bed sheets over some sticks. And a lot of them were built right up in the street, which made traffic pretty difficult. There were just kind of people everywhere, and it was definitely a little more chaotic than usual. We got there, I think we arrived in Laogan about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we set up our tents really quickly and then got to work putting together a clinic. There was a building that was still standing that kind of had two wings, and so we strung kind of strings in between the wings and threw tarps over those, and that became our clinic.
At that point, were in that area, had there been medical treatment for the people, or were you treating people who had not been treated at all?
Well, the day before we got there, there was a team from Japan that had showed up, mm-hmm. and the group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, had shown up also the day before. But there was still, you know, for the first week, I'd say, we saw a lot of wounds that hadn't been evaluated before.
An estimated 3,000 injured people you treated in this makeshift clinic. What type of injuries did you see?
We saw a lot of lower extremity injuries for some reason. A lot of broken bones, a lot of open fractures where the bone was sticking through the skin. Everything was pretty badly infected. There were just some simple lacerations. There were a lot of scalp lacerations that were pretty severe that, again, had not been – nobody had touched those since the earthquake, which was really amazing. I saw a lot of hip and pelvis fractures and a lot of soft tissue injury. And then there was a lot of kind of psychological distress that followed the earthquake as well that is what we found pretty difficult to treat, really.
Mm. Peter Tien, describe your work in the critical care unit at this large hospital in Port-au-Prince.
Well, my project out there was a support medical team that was going down. The project was funded by Church of Scientology, and we had over 200 medical personnel down there. And I was down there as part of the support. One night, I was part of a team that three of us, we ran a critical care unit. And I said, you know, kind of having a better understanding of a healthcare situation when you have a licensed practical nurse, a dentist, and a funeral director running a critical care unit. Mm-hmm. We had no electricity. It was part of the general hospital, which is the main hospital in town just near the palace. It had received structural damage. So we had lack of lights. We had a lack of airflow. We had 50 patients in the wing. Patients range from a set of twins, premature twins, up to the elderly, people with crushing injuries. We had a couple patients that were on dialysis. Just total lack of supplies. I know one time we had to go change IV bottles, and we needed 25 IV bags, and they went to the supply room and said, here's four. Mm-hmm. And so then the decision had to be made which ones, you know, who was going to be hydrated and who weren't. You know, so it was a very long night, very gruesome night being in there. There's a lot of lack of medicine, pain medicine. And then just as we thought we were making headway, then we had a patient go into a massive GI bleed that really complicated the situation. Mm-hmm. Healthcare down there, Chris, and maybe you've seen this before, is, you know, I'm told a lot of times that night the nurses and everybody just kind of leave. And it's you'll find family members sleeping in the bed with the patient or on the floor next to the patient, and the family members become a primary health care provider.
At the same time, are some of the health care workers, the people of Haiti, afraid of going back into the buildings?
Absolutely. The building we were in had structural damage. Near the complex we had, there was the collapse of the medical school, both for doctors and nurses. So several hundred nurses and doctors were killed just nearby here, and that really scared the staff of being in there. They, you know, it was just not a comforting position to be in this building knowing it could happen anytime.
Peter Tien, you are remarkable in that you've been involved in helping out in most of the major disasters in recent memory. Mm-hmm. Around the world. What set this one apart for you? How was it different than the tsunami, for instance?
Yeah, I think the two that come close would be the tsunami and the work I did in Darfur. And I've thought about that often. And to me, this was far worse. I mean, the weather was horrible, the massive destruction, the lack of infrastructure. I mean, we're looking at a country that had no real infrastructure before the disaster. At least the other experiences, there was some organization beforehand. There was no one to go to, a government agency, or the people had no expectations of the government because there was no expectations before the disaster. And it was just this desperation. You know, there was no, you know, the UN and the U.S. Army was doing a great job of trying to organize it. But there was this desperateness because people, as Chris was saying, felt that an earthquake was going to happen at any time. Lack of trust. I know when we were running the critical care unit, one of the things I worked on was getting a young 23-year-old engineer student off to the USS Comfort because he had a crushed leg wound. It was bleeding. It was seeping very bad. He needed dialysis, but he would not go to the Comfort because he was told on the street, don't trust him. Anybody who goes to the Comfort is going to have their limbs amputated.
Mm. And did you find this sort of this view as well,
yeah,
Dr. Burge?
I think there was, we actually ended up performing quite a few amputations, and I think people appropriately had a real fear of that. I mean, in a country like Haiti, the only way to make a living usually is through physical labor. There's not a lot of jobs. The economy doesn't support a lot of jobs for people that are educated. They don't have a lot of desk jobs there. And so if you want to make a living, you have to be able to carry heavy bags of rice, or you have to be able to farm corn, or you have to be able to, you know, do heavy physical labor. And so an amputation for these people means that they can't feed their families anymore.
This was an exercise for you as an emergency medicine physician in making do with your tent. You are certainly not outfitted to the degree you would be here at the University of Iowa, hospitals and clinics. Can you give us an example, maybe an example of amputation, where it is just much different? The patient has to put up with much different circumstances and pain.
Yeah, it's so different. It's really hard to believe that we're in the same, you know, hemisphere. It's hard to believe that I can walk out of my driveway and be standing under these tarps in about 14 hours. The amputations that we did, we were actually very lucky. I went down there prepared to do amputations and terrified of doing them, but ready to if we needed to. And about 24 hours after I got there, we had an orthopedic surgeon arrive. And so we'd seen a few patients that I knew needed amputations, but they weren't dying from their wounds. And so we put them on antibiotics and told them to come back in 48 hours. And sure enough, here came an orthopedic surgeon. But we didn't have pain medicine, and so a lot of these amputations, we had a little bit of sedative, and we would try and knock them out. And
Knock them out how? With a sedative?
We used a medicine called ketamine, which is used pretty commonly in veterinary clinics, actually. And so we were able to kind of knock them out for the surgery, but then they woke up, and all we really had to give them was Tylenol. And so I think there was a lot of suffering. You know, it was really heartbreaking because – the people didn't complain. I don't know if this was your experience, but people really didn't complain. They said, you know, it hurts, but I know this is the best you can do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know I was in a surgery with standing in the surgical suite. They were doing an 8-year-old, a massive abdominal injuries. They were going in. Just as they were going in, they didn't have anything to create a clean field on her, mm-hmm. you know, as far as disinfecting the area. They just as they began cutting into her, they had a power outage that lasted for several hours. So they're doing surgery on this old girl's abdomen without electricity, without any
flashlights.
Flashlights. You know, they had no way to stop cauterize the bleeding. They had really very little pain medicine. I mean, she was lightly sedated, and they said when she comes out of this, again, it's going to be the Tylenol. They didn't have anything stronger for her. And I think, my God, you know, how much awful could it get for this little 8-year-old girl?
Yeah, I was just amazed. You know, we had a lot of children with fractures, and we'd have to move them around a lot, and they wouldn't complain at all. They'd say, thank you, you know, when you were done.
Dr. Chris Burrish of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, emergency medicine physician, along with Peter Tien. They both just returned from Haiti helping out in the disaster zone there. If you have a question about helping the victims of the earthquake in Haiti for our guests, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, I want to pick up on a point that Dr. Burrish mentioned, the mental anguish. The physical part is one side of this, but how will this trauma be healed in so many lives? When we come back, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Ben Kiefer, and we're back talking about the disaster in Haiti with University of Iowa emergency medicine physician Chris Burrish and Peter Tien, licensed funeral director in Cedar Rapids, longtime national spokesperson for the American Red Cross. They have both just returned from Haiti. In fact, Peter Tien returned just yesterday, sharing their experiences. If you have a question, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about, you talked earlier about the horrific physical challenges you had to face and help there in this scenario. What are the mental challenges that these people will be facing in the years to come? How are those to be helped?
Well, I think we touched on the fact that people are terrified of going into buildings. And it's hard to imagine that changing anytime real soon. You know, even when we were there last week, there were still buildings coming down every now and then, seemingly for no good reason. And there were still, you know, some aftershocks. So I think that sort of stress and trauma is going to be there for a long time. Almost everybody that I talked to down there had lost a relative. Mm-hmm. We're struggling with depression and a lot of anxiety. You know, everybody's living on the street. Like I mentioned, nobody knows where their next meal's coming from. Nobody knows if they're going to have a job. I mean, businesses aren't open right now because they're inside and nobody wants to go inside. Nobody wants to work inside. Nobody wants to shop inside. And so I think there's a lot of stress. Almost everybody I talked to said that they can't eat and they can't sleep. And it's, you know, and some of our friends, actually longtime friends, lost a lot of relatives. And we had a few children die while we were there that, you know, for really what in the United States would be no good reason. I mean, we lost one kid because the insulin we had got too warm and we didn't have the ability to refrigerate it. And some of these kids, you know, like their mother would come in and say, I just lost my other four kids in the earthquake.
Mm. And how do you react as a physician to that?
You don't. I mean, I don't think there's any way that you react as a physician. I think you react as a human being. You know, I think there's not much you can do except, you know, be with them and do what you can to console them.
Peter Tian, as a mental health professional, what did you see there as the grave challenges facing these people?
Well, I think it kind of ends up being, along with what Chris was saying, kind of the cultural shock of even respect for their dead. I mean, here is a population that they're very ritualistic with their dead. It reflects on their religious and cultural values. It gives them, you know, their beliefs going forward. And yet 200 and some thousand died. We don't know the amount. Up to a couple of days ago, they were still burning the bodies in the street. The city was picking up their dead, throwing them in garbage trucks, stacking them in piles like cords of wood in their general hospital where I was working, and then hauling them off on garbage trucks and dumping them in landfills and oftentimes not even covering them. I mean, that is shocking for that population. So not all the – in addition, all the factors are saying – that Chris was saying, you have all these issues of insulting their culture and their religious beliefs that will really undermine – they have nothing really to grab on because what do they trust anymore? I think the other thing with the emotional aspect is the workforce. I mean, all these workers that we're seeing going in impacting, we know studies show that 50% of responders of these type of disasters will suffer what we refer to as post-traumatic stress, which is not post-traumatic stress disorder, but an impact on the responder's life that will last up and but diminish by the end of 6 months. So 50% of the people going down to help will be less than 100% functioning for the next 6 months. And we know of the responders that generally about 32% will expect to get post-traumatic stress disorder, which is life-changing impact.
Having experienced many disasters, being on the scene many times, what is the way you cope with this? Out of it, it must be an incredible shock to come from Iowa, go there, and then return almost as if it's just a nightmare you're awaking from.
Well, it is. I don't know for Chris, but I remember landing in the United States and just walking into the airport. I was disoriented. It was a whole – things just didn't jive. And I've done 45 major disasters around the world. Right. But every time it's the same, it's like you've got to come back to reality and snap back. It's like being woken away, made awake. We have the luxury of coming out of that area. You know, those people live in that. You know, and you look at the living conditions, you're saying the impact not going into the building. They're running into the rainy season here. It's going to start raining hard on them, which is going to undermine the buildings, which is going to drench them as they live in the street. As Chris is saying, at night on a four-lane road, they close half the road off and people are sleeping in the road. Now the fear of I can't go in the building because it's going to collapse on me. I've lost all my family members. I've lost a lot of things I believed or trusted in. And now we're going to get rained on, which is going to make health conditions a lot worse. The physical and emotional long-term issues are absolutely incredibly and stunning in this situation.
Dr. Burrish, when you first arrived there, was it easy to step into the role that you needed, or did you have to have a time for the initial shock to wear off and adapt to it?
I think I was pretty fortunate. We had a team of people that most of whom had just returned with me, you know, 3 days before the earthquake, and all of them were kind of emergency professionals. And so I think everybody kind of had this mindset that, hey, we're here, we've got a job to do, let's get to work. And so we literally within an hour of hitting leg on had our clinic, you know, had the tarps mostly up and we're starting to run patients through our clinic. And so I think that there was a little bit of shock, but honestly, I don't think anybody kind of stopped to process much until, some people probably still haven't stopped to process it too much.
Did you? How many decisions did you have to make? Perhaps this was a matter of several per hour. I don't know about who triage, who would receive treatment and who would not with those limited resources.
Well, we treated everybody. You know, people that you know, we were there. We got there a week after the quake, and so people that had lived for a week after having a building fall on top of them, if we couldn't get to them that night, we're probably still going to be around the next morning. If it didn't, you know, we kept several patients with us overnight each night. That we were more worried about. But I think we were able to treat everybody. I don't think we had to turn anybody away, but some people did have to come back the following day or spend the night with us in the tents, and we would work on them overnight.
I wanted to talk before we have to leave here at the end of the hour that you are going to return, Dr. Burrish, to travel back in a few days to work up to set up a permanent hospital in Haiti. What are your plans?
They're still evolving, and I'm sure Peter has this experience too that they change kind of by the minute, oftentimes while you're in the air. I'm not entirely sure. I'm hoping to get back there on Tuesday to help set up this. It's a field hospital that's a professional grade field hospital instead of our TARPs. Mm-hmm. And we'll hope to have that up and running by the middle of next week and be able to keep that running until we can rebuild or repair the hospital that's in Laogan right now.
A couple of closing comments from the both of you, if we could. We have about 2 minutes left. Let's talk about the future. Where does Haiti go from here? Where do we go from here in terms of coping with disasters like this? What are the lessons learned, Peter Tien?
Well, I think one of the things we have to do is make sure that we believe that this disaster is more serious than a six-week stint. You know, and that America tends to lose interest after 6 weeks. The amputations of these children and the adults that Chris was mentioning earlier, these people are going to need physical therapy. They're going to need long-term care. And someone just told me, a physical therapist just told me last night, there's only two physical therapists on the island. And so if you're saying, you know, if these people are going to have to make life-adjusting moves, they're going to need help, as people do in all disasters. Look at Iowa City, Cedar Rapids from the floods of 2008. This thing is going to be a lifetime. We can't lose interest in 6 weeks.
Okay, a closing comment from you, Dr. Burrish, looking forward.
I think for a long time, you know, there have been a lot of people that have been trying to get the world's attention focused on Haiti. And while I hate that it took an earthquake to make that happen, I think hopefully now that we have so many people interested and so many different NGOs interested in working together so well on the ground, that we can start to rebuild some basic infrastructure that is so desperately needed in terms of healthcare, education, and agriculture. Just to name a few. And so I think this is a real opportunity to marshal these resources in a comprehensive sort of response to this.
On a lighter note, Peter Tien, you remarked before the interview very quickly, you co-piloted John Travolta's plane down there, John Travolta sitting in the pilot's seat.
Well, I didn't co-pilot. I was in the cockpit with John, but yeah, he flew his own personal 707 down there. 24 of us were on board with him, and we had 5,000 pounds of medical supply, but I had the opportunity of sitting up in the cockpit with John as he flew the plane down there. Very talented pilot, very gentle giant. I really like John. I've met him before. And he was very compassionate.
Thank you very much for coming in to the both of you. Peter Tien, licensed funeral director in Cedar Rapids, longtime national spokesperson for the American Red Cross, and has dealt with many major disasters on site in recent years. Also thanks to Dr. Chris Burrish. Both have just returned from Haiti and have shared their experiences with us. We hope to get an update from both of you in the future. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment after the break, a conversation with Blackhawk County Public Health Director Tom O'Rourke. He's retiring. He'll reflect on his 36 years in the public health sector. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow, a lighter comedic twist on the news, from Mike Myers to Steve Carell, from Stephen Colbert to Tina Fey. Chicago's Second City Theater has always provided a comedic twist on our news and pop culture. This weekend, the legendary comedy troupe returns to Iowa for performances. And tomorrow on this program, I'll have members of the troupe as my guests, along with Mike Thomas, author of the new book, The Second City Unscripted. My next guest is Blackhawk County Public Health Director Tom O'Rourke. Tom is retiring after 36 years. At the end of February, he joins us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Cedar Falls. Good afternoon to you, Tom.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Great to have you with us. So we want to take this opportunity to the opportunity of your coming retirement to talk about the changes and the challenges that you have come up against in the public health sector. And let's start with the 1973, I believe. Was that when you got into this position?
1973 was the year that I first walked into the Black Hawk County Courthouse. The public health office was on the second floor. There were 11 people there in an office that was built for three. But that was the entire public health department at that time. We have since then moved out of the courthouse into, basically five other locations, one major office in the Pinecrest Building in Waterloo, which is formerly a Wheaton Franciscan Hospital some 40 years ago, also into some school-based clinics. So the years between 1973 and today as we speak have shown us a lot of growth, has shown us a lot of change in what we do and how we do public health business.
Mm-hmm. What is the biggest changes you've noticed in terms of public health thinking? The facilities have been improved, but how has that developed over the years, the thinking about public health and the policies?
Public health thinking and policies has a way of going around and coming around. We keep getting reminded of our roots. The most recent reminder was your previous guest talking about the earthquake in Haiti and the fact that the infrastructure has been so badly damaged and depleted that there is sickness and suffering all over the entire country. And this goes back to the fact that the basic essence, the structures that support life, the water supply, the food supply, the housing stock, have been torn apart by the travail of that earthquake. And the folks are left there with the most basic of needs. That is kind of the story of public health going around and coming around again. In this country, the biggest achievements of public health occurred between 1850 and 1950, when we did exactly the same thing for our country as is being redone in Haiti now. That is to clean up the food and water supply, to get a good housing supply, to keep people living in a wholesome environment. This was followed up, or this went for about 50 years, was followed up by the immunization achievements that occurred between about 1900 and 1950, when things like smallpox, polio were addressed. And we found ourselves with a healthier country to live in. When I came in 1973, I think we were probably at the low point of that basic phase. That is, we had completed a very excellent public infrastructure in the water, the roads, the food. And we found that the medical facilities were pretty bare bones, pretty plain Jane sort of things, mm-hmm. in the sense that the hospitals were very utilitarian, but not very fancy. The physicians were spread out in office buildings around the town. There were not a great many medical practitioners, and we did not depend on the medical system to cure all of our ills and ailments. If we fast forward to today, I think what we see is the fact that the medical industrial complex has grown tremendously, that we as a people no longer depend on fixing up our own sewage and water systems or pitching in and making sure the food is clean. We expect the instant cure from the medical industrial complex. And I think we are at the point now where we have pretty well exhausted or saturated that alternative. I think we're going to be going back now to more basic public health.
Mm-hmm. So it seems that you're leading it towards the discussion of the healthcare debate. At least that's where I want to steer this right now.
Sure.
From your personal perspective as a county public health director for many decades, what are your observations? So the current healthcare bill seems to be quite in question.
Mm-hmm.
Your observations on that bill and just the tenor of the debate that we've been experiencing for over a year.
I guess I want to look at the general picture. If we go back to the history of how we got to where we're at, it began in World War II when there was a government freeze on wages and employers could not give more money to their people and wanted a way to enhance their reward, and so they started throwing in free health care, and it became an employer-based system. It has since moved forward. As we look at that system today, I am of the opinion that no rational human being could design a system that looks like the one that we have, design it from scratch, and think it was anything approaching efficiency, anything approaching consistency, anything approaching effectiveness. What has happened is I think we started with a system different than the other industrialized countries. They looked for a single payer source and kept it very simplistic. Ours became much more complicated. Getting health care paid for today is and can be a nightmare. The public health system has been drawn into this in the sense that the federal government has provided more federally financed health care clinics, but it needs to go much deeper than that. I am not thoroughly conversant with the health care bill that is out there. I believe that once we work our way through the present set of circumstances at some point in time, and that point in time can be 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, whatever, we will end up with a single-payer system. It's really the only logical way to have an equitable distribution of the medical goods and services that people are asking for in the medical marketplace.
Wow, that's surprising considering the debate that we've had, that you would have a thought that that's the only place we can arrive at with the stiff opposition, especially from the Republicans.
And again, I'm a retiring local public health director, so I speak with a worm's eye point of view. Getting to there from here is going to be extremely difficult. I think it's simply a matter of more and more people losing coverage, more and more people going to some sort of emergency coverage to the point where the present system can't even make sense. There are simply too many flaws. There are simply too many negatives in it to do a quick fix, a Band-Aid sort of an approach.
Mm-hmm. Will we reach a sort of tipping point that we will be able to recognize?
I can't tell you when it is, but I'm really quite sure that we will. We're talking about 40 million people are uninsured. Other numbers, and I haven't looked at these lately, so I ask you not to hold me to them religiously. If we look at gross national product, the amount of money spent by this country on medical care is approximately 17%. I don't know how many trillions of dollars that constitutes, but 17% of our gross national product. Every other industrialized country in this world spends around 10% or less. They have better health outcomes and they have higher satisfaction from their users. So I guess as this one public health director in one county in Iowa rides off into the sunset, I have to believe that those two numbers really tell the whole story. We can't keep spending more of our gross national product on something that's giving us lesser and lesser benefits as we move along.
My guest in this half hour of The Exchange, Tom O'Rourke. He will be retiring at the end of February as a longtime director of the Blackhawk County, the public health director, after 36 years. We're reflecting on his years and his observations about our public health. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100 or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Specifically, if I could have you focus on children's health, how have child health care issues changed over the years?
Well, when I first became involved in local public health, we had a very rudimentary system of going to church basements or other public type halls where we could set up, bring in our boxes of records and supplies, and set up a clinic and see children for very essentially well care sorts of things. I've seen that grown now. We've had here in Blackhawk County, the People's Community Health Clinic is a federally financed health care committee, which clinic, which has a good many pediatricians and does excellent, excellent comprehensive care. So in that sense, it is improving. We're getting away from just the vaccine clinics for kids, which is another element of what I saw early on, to just give them their vaccines, their vaccinations. Now we're moving towards the entire physical examination, the comprehensive physical, to catch the other conditions that are not necessarily addressed by vaccines.
Is child health care an area where you say in your tenure we've most excelled?
Yes. Certainly it was the place to start, because that is the beginning, and a good beginning is going to give a better chance for a sound development throughout life. That has improved considerably, and I think it's something we should be proud of.
Mm-hmm. But we've had lately the development of the obesity epidemic among children, which presents another challenge.
There's another whole set of issues with that, how we eat, what we eat, how children are cared for. The fact that I can look back with nostalgia to my early days of playing baseball in the neighborhood and getting a lot of physical activity to a glimpse of today's children who are planted in front of video boxes and IT games and essentially not partaking of the real physical activity that I think should be built into a lifestyle early on in life.
Mm-hmm. What's the answer to that? Because you said we're planted in front of them. My experience having teenagers is they plant themselves there
and they sure do.
They don't move. So what is the answer? We have these electronics that are becoming, and it really is not an exaggeration, mm-hmm. I would say, to say addictive.
My sense here, Ben, is if I had a good answer that we knew worked, I probably wouldn't be allowed to retire. I think I'd be pulled back into service. Obviously, it's between parents and children. Obviously, it has to do with making physical activity more attractive and electronic activity less attractive.
Mm-hmm.
How to get there from here, I think we need smarter folks than me.
What do you hope will be your lasting legacy after 36 years as the director of the Blackhawk County Public Health?
I think the legacy that I would look forward to the most is twofold. One is that we started with a small single county operation that took care of the folks in Blackhawk, and now we do business in nine surrounding counties various areas that we have expanded into the schools, and that we are doing more of a regional more of a comprehensive approach instead of just a lot of little fragmented programs. I guess I would like my legacy to go on and say further that we began with about 11 people, as I mentioned earlier. We now have over 100 employees, professionals, paraprofessionals, excellent, hardworking staff. And I guess I would want my legacy to be that those folks were able to practice their professionalism to give the preventive services that are necessary to improving the overall health of Black Hawk County, and finally, ultimately, to say to themselves and others that the Black Hawk County Health Department was a good place to work.
James in Black Hawk County in Cedar Falls writes us an email and asks you to comment on the food programs at our elementary and middle high and high schools. James asks, is it a matter of economics? Why don't we become proactive in getting healthy food in the stomachs of our children?
Excellent question, James. I think it's something that should be and should have been dealt with at the policy level for a good many years prior to this conversation. Clearly, one of the problems here is the same sort of thing we have with the video games. We know what the kids like, and it's easy to basically bend and yield to the desires of the young folks and to make them happy. I'm not sure that making them happy is contributing to making them healthy. I think a good nutrition program in the schools, a sound nutrition program, is fundamental and should be in every school in every county in this state.
During your tenure, we only have a few minutes left, but during your tenure, your office has been involved in a number of controversial issues, a study of confined animal feeding operation, the coal plant more very recently in Black Hawk County, right. Others. Which of the controversies do you will sort of stay with you as a, I don't know, highlight is the best word. I'm not sure about that.
It's tough to pick one. I think, again, the confined animal feeding operation, the CAFOs, is one that sticks with me as a very fundamental disagreement between groups of people, all of whom have are looking to do the right thing, but find themselves in conflict with each other. Farming is bedrock activity in this state. Growing livestock is part of that farming, and the odor that comes with it is just basically a part of the process that is bound to be there. It is also true that other folks want to live in this area and not be assailed and assaulted by the tremendously negative odor that can come out of those confinements. It's trying to find the balance and the common ground. The Board of Health worked very hard on that. Ultimately, it became the problem of the Department of Natural Resources, and so they continue to deal with it. But I think that's something all Iowans need to join hands on and look for a common solution.
Just a couple minutes left, but in your position, you've been forced to become at times somewhat of a media star, even a national spotlight star at times with the E. coli, mumps.
Mm-hmm.
What have you learned from your years of experience with the media?
My experience with the media is the media has its own agenda and needs to sell stories and to appeal to their listenership or their readership. They are usually very willing to work with public health folks who have zero advertising budgets and can't pay to get a message out. We become an excellent team when we join together, and they help us promote the positive public health message. We've been through a pandemic flu influenza situation, and I can only thank the media for every time they have once again delivered the message, cover your cough, contain the disease, and clean your hands. It is education. It's the cheapest form of prevention. And it still works the best of anything we have.
Tom O'Rourke, we have about 30 seconds left. Just time enough to ask you, what are you looking most forward to in retirement after February is through?
I have about 300 trees in my yard that I have planted or nurtured or would like to move and move around. I love to landscape. I love the summers in Iowa, and I'm looking to putting all of that together.
Very good. Well, good luck in shaping your landscape in your yard, as successful we wish you to be as you have been in shaping the landscape of public health in Iowa, in eastern Iowa. Congratulations on your many years of service and your coming retirement, to Tom O'Rourke.
Thank you, Ben.
And that brings our program to the end today. Our program is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. Producer assistant today was Christina Sarnelli. Technical support also from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Perhaps you have a suggestion for a future topic you'd like us to address in discussion. You can reach us anytime by writing to The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.